BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. And here's round one, which is about the meanings of words. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words right. Dillis Powell, what is a kepi, K-E-P-I, or kepi, K-E-P-I?
It's a kind of hat.
But who wears it?
It's a military hat.
Yeah, and what kind of...
It has a peak.
Yes. And which army?
Which army? French.
Yes, it'll do. Well done, two marks. It's a French military cap with a horizontal peak and a flat top sloping forward. Oh, like a car the wrong way around. Worn in the French Foreign Legion, it used to be. Now, Dennis Norden. Dennis, what is fantan? F-A-N-T-A-N. Fantan.
Fantan. It sounds like what you'd get if you were sitting near an electric fan into which somebody poured a bottle of brown boot polish. But I believe it's actually a Chinese game of cards, isn't it? They play it in Sax Roma stories.
That's it, yes. Two marks it is. Chinese gambling game, the original form, concerned coins rather than cards, and they put them under a bowl. You had to guess how many coins there were there. But there is a version played with cards. Two marks. And Scott James, what is a creche?
Oh, it's a place where there's a lot of caterwauling.
Well, that might be a sort of cat's home.
Well, it's a nursery for tinies, either infants or tiny tots.
Yes, it's a public nursery for infants whose mothers are out at work. Frank Muir, I think this is harder. What is a lev? L-E-V.
A lev, sir. A lev is... A what?
That's there. L-E-V. Lev.
Lev. Lev is what a schoolboy at Eton College goes to when he's being excused.
It's a coin.
The what?
A coin.
It'd be
it's a coin. It's a coin.
But don't
it's,
be marvellous.
It's what he puts in the thing when he goes to a public lair.
Yes, in which country?
Ah. Well.
Let's run through them. Hungary.
Can't think of
it. Getting very close.
No, not
eastward.
Eastward.
Oh, eastern south, sorry.
Mesopotamia.
No.
I'm going back a bit.
I'm helping you.
Albania.
No, that's west. I'm going to give you 1.5 marks for ingenuity.
You've got it in time.
Bravery and various qualities.
You've got it.
It's a unit of money in Bulgaria, which was formerly equivalent to the franc, and as everybody knows, of course, it's equivalent to 100 stotinki.
Oh, naturally.
Well, before we start round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and the two women members of the team will go on, I hope, studying those quotations. And at the end of the programme, I shall ask them the source of the quotation. Now, here for Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, oh, east is east, and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, my head is bloody but unbound. And at the end of the programme, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Round two is about classical mythology. Two marks for correct answers. Dillis Powell, who is Phaethon?
He was the one who got mixed up with driving something.
Indeed.
He
tried to drive the horses of the sun.
Yes.
Whose sun?
What happened?
UN. and they got out of control.
Yes.
And that was the end of him.
Roughly, yes.
Well,
it was the end of him, but they were out of control. But there was a.
Well, then somebody, the sun had to come in and sort of look after them. Helios.
Yes, Helios
had to come in and sort of get hold of the reins.
Not quite. 1.5, I think.
Ah.
I'm being a bit tough on this.
You are.
Python was the son, as Dillis says, of Helios, the sun god, and much against his will, his father was persuaded to let his son drive the Sun Chariot across the sky for one day. But Phaethon was too weak to hold the horses, and so they swooped up to the heaven and nearly set that on fire, and they swooped down to the earth and really did start setting that on fire. And so Zeus, the head of all the gods, had to finish off Phaethon with a flash of lightning, lest worst might happen. He had a lot of sisters who'd harnessed the chariot for him, and they went on weeping and weeping so much that Zeus took pity on them, turned them all into poplars, and their tears became amber. 1.5 marks. Dennis Norton, who was Typhon? T-Y-P-H-O-N. Well, he is sometimes called Typhoeus.
Is he? Well, that's what happens. Moving that. Typhon, you're prepared to be very tough on this, aren't you? He was a foreigner. He was a Greek sea god who lives today in the phrase Typhon the ocean wave. Alternatively, I will accept any hand that's offered to me.
Was he one of the giants?
Yes.
He was one of the giants. Mm.
Mm. A giant who fought Zeus. 1 out of 2. He was one out of two. Monster with 100 snake heads on him. And he married a girl called Echidna, who again was fairly odd because she was half woman and half serpent. Became the father of the three-headed dog Cerberus, another many-headed dog called Orthus, the Sphinx, the Hydra, and the dragon which guarded the apples of the Hesperides. And he had this great fight with Zeus, and Zeus drove him down to Earth again, to Tartarus, and, according to one legend, piled Mount Etna on top of him to keep him there. All right, Anne Scott James, who was Andromache?
Andromache, Troy.
Yes.
She was the wife of Hector.
Yes, absolutely right. 2 marks. Fechner, where was Elysium?
Somewhere near Greece, I should imagine. There's a field of it in Paris.
Yes?
The Champs-Élysées.
And that's quite material to the story.
Which are the fields of, not paradise, which is the Persian word for walled garden.
Ah, well,
Elysium was a kind of Greek Valhalla.
Yes, yes.
That's where they all ended up. With one visualizes sort of green grass and pillars with nothing on top of them.
Yes. It was the paradise, or the Isles of the Blessed, it was later called by the Greeks, but Homer calls it a beautiful meadow, hence the Champs-Élysées, a beautiful meadow at the western extremity of the earth. No snow, no storm, nor rain, but the cool west wind breathes there forever. And favored heroes got there without ever having to die before they got there. All right. The next round is a round of rhyming slang. 2 marks. Can you guess what the following rhyming slang expressions refer to? Beginning with Dillis Power. Tiddlywink.
Drink.
Yes.
Thank you.
Tiddly.
That's right. Tiddlywink stands for drink. The abbreviation is a little bit tiddly. Dennis Norton, Sweeney Todd.
Cod? Would it be boiled cod? Sweeney Todd?
Yeah. No, I didn't have that.
You're going to get it, yeah?
It's the Flying Squad.
Oh, that's rather good.
The Wide Boys and Lairbats call them the Sweeneys, or did. Mm. And Scott James, Johnny Horner.
Corner.
Yep. Round the Johnny Horner. He's round the corner, or even he's gone round the Johnny for a tiddly or a drink. 2 marks.
Drinking and
then comes a little Jack Horner, I suppose. Frank Muir, Hampstead Heath.
Umbrella.
No.
Hampstead Heath, teeth.
Yes.
I've got to get my Hampsteads are giving me a bit of trouble.
That's right. Hampstead Heath is teeth. I've lost one of my Hampsteads, or similar phrases. 2 marks. Next round is the origins and derivations of words and expressions and phrases. And what I want is 2 things from each member of the team. First of all, what's the present meaning, and then the origin. Dillis Powell, bag and baggage.
Bag and baggage means altogether. You throw somebody out, bag and baggage, you chuck them out of the house completely. Mm-hmm. Bag and baggage.
Origin?
Army term?
Yes, indirectly.
Indirectly an army.
Oh, no, almost directly.
Almost directly?
Yes. You asked me a rather difficult question. I can't very easily give you a straight answer.
It's unusual because it's singular and plural, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the only point of it.
bag and baggage.
It is a particular
time.
Occasion, and I think it would have been very difficult for you to have known what it was, but two out of three. Bag and baggage means now utterly or with all your belongings. It was coined by Gladstone in the House of Commons on the 7th of May, 1877. The Turks, one and all, bag and baggage, shall, I hope, clear out from the province they have desolated and profaned. And he was the first chap to use it.
Hence Gladstone bag.
Exactly. Two, I think. To have the lion's share.
Well, it means to have the major part.
Yes.
I think it comes from some one of these animal fables.
Yes.
Of whoever wrote animal fables. La Fontaine.
Oh, Aesop.
Aesop?
Yes.
Aesop.
That's it. And do you remember the story?
No, Jack, you tell it, because you tell them so well.
One and a half, I think. It means to have the lion's share means to have the largest or best part. Portion, and the fable of Aesop is where the lion, as king of the beasts, divided the spoils of conquest in the following way: a quarter to himself for his superior courage, a quarter to his family, yet another quarter to himself as his right, and as for the rest, let who will dispute it with me.
I've always wanted an accountant like that.
I think it was one and a half was fair. Anne Scott James. Out on a limb.
It means you're isolated. You're away from the crowd, doing something on your own.
A little more than that, I think, Anne.
At some peril.
Yes. Yes, I think you've got to bring that in as an idea.
Now, out on a limb, I should have thought it means you climbed a tree and can't get down. You got stuck out on a limb of a tree. That's what we think.
Well, it means that you are in a position of some danger. Usually somebody's got you exactly where he wants you. That's the idea of out on a limb. And it is exactly what it says. If you've climbed a tree and you've climbed along one of the branches, if somebody's coming after you, you can't get back because he'll get you. And if you go further out along the limb, the branch will break, and so it will if he saws it off. So there it is. You're stuck. Frank Muir, in the swim.
Means that you're in the centre of things.
Yes.
You're loitering with intent in the corridors of power.
And from?
And from. Derivation.
Mm.
It's nothing to do with mixed bathing.
not human mixed bathing, no.
In which case, it's probably the angling term.
Yes, it is.
Where the swim is usually a kind of narrow part of the river, or a placid part after a kind of venturi effect in the river, where the food gathers and most of the fish gather too.
You're absolutely dead right. Well done. 3 miles.
Not just a pretty voice, you know.
A quickie round of abbreviations and initials. 2 marks for getting them right. Phyllis Power, RCO.
Royal College of
Organists.
Yes. Royal College of Royal College of Organists it is. Good mark.
Royal College of
Dennis Norton. S R N.
State registered nurse.
Yes, quite right. To be distinguished from a state enrolled nurse, I'm told. Anne Scott James. VHF.
Very high frequency.
2 marks. And Frank Muir, W.O.
Wobanobby. Women only. The Walthamstow Observatory. In the RAF warrant officer.
Yes.
War office.
Yes, that'll do, that'll do. All right, you get your 2 marks.
Oratorio Society.
That'll do. War office and warrant officer are the most usual of the list that Frank gave you.
Ask me another.
I have done quite a lot of others. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Phyllis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Oh, east is east and west is west and never the twain shall meet.
It's a poem by Kipling, Rudyard.
Yes. Rudyard Kipling, Oh, East is East and West is West, and never the twain shall meet. The Ballad of East and West. It's quite a simple title. Now, Anne Scott James, the origin of your quotation, my head is bloody but unbowed.
Well, we have consulted our quotation, and we think it is by Henley.
Yes. Title?
Invictus.
Invictus.
That's right. W.E. Henley, poem called Invictus. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Tomorrow. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back to Frank Muir and his quotation, "Oh, East is East, and West is West, and never the twain shall meet."
I want to talk to you tonight about your drains. I'm really qualified to talk about drains because the village where I live, Thorpe in Surrey, we're not on the main drainage system. We're not a member of the effluent society. we still have the old septic tank arrangement. I'm a bit of an expert on this because ours has gone wrong. And I reckon locally, round about the Thorpe area, as being a bit of a drain brain. Now, the other week, my drain from the kitchen sink got blocked up, you see, and I put my brain to this. Now, you know, in the past, I've given you the benefit of many of my inventions. Well, tonight, I'm going to tell you how you need never have any more trouble with blocked drains again. It's the detergent what does it, you know. It's the detergent. It sort of makes a sort of white pastry thing inside the pipe. And anyway, I've got a device for passing down the pipe, which is called a sweeps machine, which is rather sweet. It's not a machine at all. It's a bundle of canes. And I screwed those together the last time my drain blocked up, and it extended 30 feet, and I pushed it through and managed to remove the obstruction, which happened to be an old Wellington boot. And I found that all the brass had locked together, and I couldn't unscrew it, so I left it out, and it all went rather rigid. Well, last Sunday, when my drain blocked up, or at least it constricted, and the water, when you pulled the plug out of the kitchen sink, the water came back at you. It's sort of abomination unto nature. It's all sort of makes you feel like a nightmare, you know, that's going to overwhelm you. And so I went out into the orchard and got the machine, which was these 12 rigid 3-foot poles, 36, and I passed it down the drain. Well, it passed through easily because the detergent, which had solidified inside, had left about an inch and a half hole in the middle. So the pole went right through. And unfortunately, it came up by the kitchen. I had to pass it through the kitchen door, through the hall, out of the front door. And then I was on the road outside. The trouble is I couldn't get it back. You see, because the malacca, or rattan, the canes, had grown hard being left out. And only had, and the turning circle of this 30-foot thing was about 9 cables. So I had to pass it, I had to walk with this thing through the general store opposite, over the cheese counter, out of the back window, round by the Jolly Gardeners, and back again. Now, what to use to pull back and get this soft white detergent out? Naturally, my first thought was the thing I tried first, which was a very stale, smallish Christmas pudding into which I'd pressed teaspoons until just a perimeter of teaspoons, and making a sort of spherical scraper. I threaded the string through that, made a very large knot, and pulled that through. This was a mistake, incidentally. Don't you try it. Old Christmas pudding will melt in the middle of the tunnel and will leave you not only your original blockage, but also 12 teaspoons and 2 sixpences wrapped in greaseproof paper. I realised then that what one's got to pull through is something which one pushes into this sort of 4.5-inch pipe and kind of expands and presses outwards. Then if one pulled on that, it would really cleanse the thing. So what I did was I got an old vest and rolled it up into a ball and tied it into a ball with twine. Then I got some baker's yeast. Now, you see my reasoning. I pushed and worked the yeast into the string of the vest, sprinkled a little sugar on the yeast. Now, no yeast is diabolical stuff. You've only got to sprinkle a bit of sugar on it. It sort of grows and grows and grows. It'll take over the world. And I pushed this little ball into the end of the hole, threaded the end of my string round it, sprinkled the sugar on and some water and left it. It was a warm evening last Sunday. When I came in the morning, marvellous, the yeast had grown and proved, or whatever it is, had swelled out, filled the hole completely. I tugged it through and I have a completely free drain. So there is your answer. There is your panacea. If your drains are blocked, that is the answer, and it would always work. As Kipling said, yeast is yeast, and vest is vest, and ever the drain shall beat.
Well, I do hope that no sanitary inspectors listen to this program, otherwise Frank's house will be declared uninhabitable. Well, now back to Dennis Norden, and if we remember, his quotation was, "My head is bloody but unbowed."
I have, in my time, written many musicals. Oh, well, mind you, when I say in my time, they were generally written in somebody else's time. During my civil defense class or mowing Mr. Muir's lawn. But I've always been very unlucky with them because somehow the ones that I have written, somebody else has written earlier on more or less the same idea. For example, my first was called My Fair Gentleman, which just did the rounds and came back. Then I did this one called The Queen and I. I didn't even look at that. Then there was one I did called South Atlantic. That had possibilities. The last one that I did had been written before by two people. I called it Maggie Poppins. So it was about this lovable, golden-hearted trollop who descended from the sky on a magic umbrella onto a seaman's mission in Liverpool. But they quibbled, you know. They quibbled about him. So you can imagine my excitement when I heard that a certain Mr. Lionel Bart was having trouble with his musical, which is based on the life of Robin Hood and was called Twang, because I had written a musical based on the life of Robin Hood, which I called, by strange coincidence, Godoying. Which I thought was much sexier. And I sent this one off to the management as a suggestion that it might be of some help, because I do believe, quite sincerely, that my version, my Godoying, brings an entirely new concept to the whole legendary myth of Robin Hood, in that it is completely filthy. Now, I honestly think that the theatre today needs filth if it is to meet the challenge of television. Now, my Godoying has three songs which are made up practically completely of a rhythmic repetition of the more mucky of the four-letter words which we use in our everyday conversation. One of them is a waltz, actually. I don't know if you've ever tried saying it as a waltz. I don't. If you'd like to among yourself, just say it to the tune of the Blue Danube, and you'll get the effect, which is at once earthy but lyrical. I have it as the big boy and girl love duet in the first act, and then she sings it by herself later when she thinks he doesn't love her anymore, and he goes off, and this new orchestra plays it very softly in the background. She says, "Listen, they're playing Our Word." I and she just sings a bit of it, and then she's overcome by sobs and runs off. It really is a moment of theatre, which I do recommend if it ever comes round your way, which it won't now, unfortunately. I had another one of these four-letter songs done as a ballet, actually, and that is tremendously effective. But they won't have it. I got this letter back from the management, unfortunately. I've been pretty brave about the whole thing now, but it was a shock. Which said, you know, they were returning the play because it'd been scorching his desk and so on. And they're very sorry, they'd have liked to have used it. They applauded the essential filth that was contained in it, but they didn't think the public would accept it as an example of Mr. Bart's work. Which is more or less where the situation ends. To sum up their letter, more or less, as W.E. Henley put it in his big hit song, Invictus, my hood is bawdy, but unbarred.
Certainly, it isn't another case for the sanitary inspector, but never mind. And by your vote, Frank Muir wins the contest of the stories, and that brings us to a final score in which Tillis Powell and Frank Muir win by 1.5 marks from Dennis and Anne Scott James. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. ¶¶